One of the main things in life is not to climb the highest peak you can, it's to enjoy the adventure along the way. I was born in 1934. You know, we didn't have a lot of money or anything. We were living in a poor housing project, but the family was together. That means so much.
Diagnosed with the deadly polio virus, Dennis survived after 6 months in the hospital.
In those days, you know, polio was kind of like the plague. You got polio, it's kind of the kiss of death, you know. And I got back home. I was very weak. And young kids can be kind of vicious, and they call you a cripple. And then along came the separation of my parents, and I was not a happy camper through that period.
Shuttled between relatives and boarding schools, Dennis worked to survive. Landing jobs in construction, he was self-sufficient by 14. After high school, Dennis sought adventure in Alaska.
Alaska definitely changed my whole character. It was a tough, strong experience, and when I left Alaska, I knew that I was on the road to live my career as an equipment operator.
Returning home, he married, and by 26 was vice president of his uncle's construction company. 3 years later, he went into business for himself. And today, Washington Companies encompasses construction, railroads, mining, and shipping as one of the largest privately held companies in America.
The early part of your life, you may get a bad hand. But remember, that's a small period in your life. If you can focus on the future by finding something that you like to do, with a little luck and the help from God, that you're going to have a good life.
Welcome to the Rainmakers Podcast. This show is going to be an exploration on the world's best investors from past and present to see how exactly they made their returns. In this episode, we will be talking about Dennis Washington. Washington is a self-made billionaire who got his start through working in construction and then leveraging his skills to starting his own company and then building an empire in construction, mining, railroads, and even fixing up and selling yachts. In today's episode, we'll be going over his journey in becoming a self-made billionaire and some lessons from some of the deals he made. This will be a fun and insightful episode. If you guys enjoy it, please subscribe and leave a review. Now, let's start our journey in learning the methods of Dennis Washington. Dennis Washington is an investor that should be intensely studied. He became a billionaire by making acquisitions in distressed companies that had labor disputes. While this is a traditional play by many private equity funds in the past, Washington's focus was on companies that were adjacent to construction. He used his expertise in construction to build a very profitable construction company where he took on projects that were only small but still profitable to pay his workers a steady income. Using his experience in dealing with labor-intensive projects, he went on an acquisition spree, buying mines, railroads, and tugboats that were distressed due to market conditions. By restructuring each company to be more efficient with a focus on the bottom line, he set up each company he purchased to be more aligned and more profitable, in the end leading him to become a billionaire. In this episode, we will go over just how he did that. But first, let's understand who he was. Dennis Washington was a person who found his passion early in life. In an interview with Forbes in 2013, he gives details on his early life saying, "I developed my instincts during childhood. I had to. I bounced around a good deal. I went to several different grade schools all over the West Coast. I got polio when I was 8 and spent 8 months in the hospital and a rehab clinic in Seattle. I lived in a government housing project with my parents during World War II and made pocket money shining shoes with my neighborhood friend, Quincy Jones." Yes, it's that Quincy Jones. "At a naval shipyard gate in Bremerton, Washington. When my parents separated, I lived with my mom for a while in California. Then went to a boarding school, then a Catholic day school. Then I was sent to my uncle and dad's place in Washington State. I didn't see my dad much. He was working construction overseas. I ended up in Missoula, Montana with my grandparents. I discovered my passion right away. I loved machinery. The day after my high school graduation in 1952, I headed to Alaska. I was 17. I started out greasing equipment, then became a heavy crane operator. I made and saved money there for 2 years. When the project was finished, I went home to visit my grandmother. I was planning to head to Spain for another project, but I met a girl at a root beer stand and decided to stay. I got a job with my uncle Hugh King's construction company. I was one of a handful of employees. I started out doing everything, running equipment and later managing logging road jobs and secondary highways. By 22, I was working on my first interstate highway job. By 26, I was vice president running all operations of a joint venture between King and a group called McLaughlin. We had four big interstate jobs. So that's just a little background on who he was in an interview in 2013. This reminds me of Novak Djokovic in an interview when he said why he was a master tennis player. He simply said, "I can carry on playing at this level because I like hitting the tennis ball. There are people out there who don't have the right motivation. You don't need to talk to them. I can see it." Dennis Washington really loved machinery in the same way. The passion became an obsession, where he spent most of his time learning how to operate new machinery. It was this obsession that led him to be a supervisor of all the operations that were going on in his uncle's construction projects. There was a common saying to pick the passionate person over the person with talent. And I think this is the millionth case of this. The passionate person will always find a way no matter what. And we will see this with Dennis Washington. He goes on later in this interview to say, "At age 29, I married a former beauty queen. Phyllis and I took what was supposed to be a two-day honeymoon during which I thought a lot about my future. But on the way home, we got lost. We got back a day late. The office manager told me that my uncle was very, very upset and that he was going to give me a lesson in the facts of life. He wouldn't need to. I decided I'd had enough and I needed a change. I had a job offer from Peter Kiewit Construction Company right after I quit. But one of my best friends, Gary Gallagher, who owned a Caterpillar dealership with his father, asked me the all-important question. With your experience and at your age, why would you want to go work for someone else? He was right. I realized, hell, if I didn't take the risk now, I'd never do it. It still left me with a very insecure feeling. I borrowed $30,000 from Gallagher's company, got a tractor and motor grader on credit, and started Washington Construction. I relied heavily on my wife. Phyllis was a teacher, and we lived mostly on her salary. Our house had an outdoor bathroom. Phyllis took the wash to the laundromat. It would be a couple of years before we had an indoor bathroom. Discipline was the key for me. In the beginning, I worked 6 days a week, and Phyllis came with me to job sites on Sundays. I got up at 4 a.m., had some toast, then headed out to the jobs. I got home at 9 or 10 at night. Even if I partied hard, I still woke up for work at 4 a.m. You're not going to make it working 8 hours a day. I knew my capabilities too. I always marked up a piece of paper before taking a job, looking at the pluses and minuses. If the latter outnumbered the former, I would pass. I saw how other contractors ate their young and lowered their bids to the point where they could make no money. I stuck to my guns and only did a job if I thought it would be profitable." Before getting married, he already had a problem with his uncle, and this was noted in a lot of different articles. And notice how complacent his uncle was being when they came to updating the machinery. It came to a point where Washington saw the company was declining while he was simply too skilled to keep working there. But the key point that changed everything for Dennis Washington that he already mentions in his interview was when his friend told him to go off on his own. He told him to be entrepreneurial. I think this is a really important part in the story because with many people who have a certain skill, they usually end up trying to find another job, which Washington himself was actually going to do. But when his friend presented that option, it opened a whole new realm of possibilities to him. This fits well with what we learned from many of the investors we've studied so far. In essence, the best investors are actually entrepreneurs. Philip Anschutz was an entrepreneur and learned his lessons in investing through his experiences as a wildcatter. Richard Rainwater was also an entrepreneur and had to build two investment organizations from the ground up. To be truly great, you have to take some swings that others wouldn't and try things that could lead to failure. Dennis Washington was no different. He didn't have money to even own the equipment, but because he had the skill in already operating different machinery and had a reputation for being a really good worker, Caterpillar allowed him to buy one of their machines on all debt with him owing $30,000. He was taking a big risk, but he knew what he was doing and kept his mind on making each project as profitable as it can be. But at the same time, he was not afraid of being in more debt. He explains later in his interview saying, "My biggest concern was always money. It was a capital-intensive business. I always tried to use other people's money as much as possible by getting 90-day credit with a 2% discount from explosives, fuel, and tire people. I was always worried about how I would pay people back. I knew that if I missed a payment, my reputation would be ruined. Even as I got more successful, I still never borrowed money for cars, boats, and homes. I never really felt financially secure until about 1988. He had real skin in the game and had a long road of constant borrowing before he'd be able to finally diversify after his first big deal in buying a mine in Montana. Just for context, he says he was only financially secure in 1988. When he started, he was only 29 years old. In 1988, he was 53 years old. That means for a majority of his life up until this point, he was on the brink of bankruptcy. He knew the risks of his business well, and I think this became a source of alpha for him. By being in such a capital-intensive business and knowing how razor-thin the margins were between continuing your operations or losing everything, he learned how to cut costs and stay disciplined while growing his construction company. When he saw others who couldn't, he would take advantage and buy them out. Now, before we get into his first deals that showed his thesis on efficiency, let's go through a couple of things that Washington did to make him successful. Number one, being opportunistic. Early on in his career, he realized that he was simply not going to play the same game by the same rules everyone else was doing. While other construction companies would simply take jobs to keep the workers paid, while at the same time putting the whole company at risk, Washington realized that being selective, he could give his company a whole different culture that was lean and opportunistic on deals. He set up his business to only do a few deals that were very profitable for the business. Construction workers obviously only get paid on the jobs that they do, so that within itself weeded out a lot of people from joining his company. His company was more like a SEAL team or special ops and not really the army. He kept his team lean but solely focused on niche deals that were very profitable and can be done by a few staff. The first project that matched this criteria was building a new road through Glacier National Park. After successfully finishing that project, he kept doing more and more forestry deals and became the largest contractor in Montana. This became his first edge because by being niche and focusing on highly profitable deals, he had a differentiated product to offer the government with his services. While his competitors commoditized their own business model, he made himself stand out as the premium service that can do harder jobs, and because of this, he got more and more jobs. But once these deals started running out, he would not try to chase and build on new deals that weren't profitable. This will now take us to the next reason why Washington was so successful. Number two, staying disciplined. When the forestry contracts ran out, Washington stayed opportunistic and decided to branch out to other niche projects like dam building. But over time, while building his construction company, he said, "I learned never to bid on contracts without a profit to just to keep people working. Pay them well, but don't be afraid to lay them off." This was his motto. I mentioned this earlier in the episode, but Washington knew early on that to make his operation work, he needed to be extremely disciplined. There was no time off. He worked 16-hour days for 6 days a week for decades to make the whole thing work. Rome wasn't built in a day, right? Nothing about what he did was actually easy, but keeping his discipline and making it one of his values of his company became an edge for him. That is the reason why investing is such a slugging percentage game. You have to be disciplined to find the fat pitch that Warren Buffett talks about. Most great investors' returns only come from a handful of deals. But remember, they weren't fortune tellers. They kept the course without seeing much success before striking on an opportunity. Being disciplined keeps you in the game and allows you to get your chance when the opportunity presents itself. Washington was no different. He kept operations tight, worked hard, and after a good 20 years of running his construction company this way, he finally got the chance to make his big break. Now, let's get into it. The deal that would put him on the Forbes list and would allow him to diversify into becoming an eventual billionaire is the Anaconda Mines in Montana. Here's the background. In 1977, ARCO bought a copper mine in Butte, Montana, called the Anaconda Copper Mine. It first opened in 1881 as Anaconda Silver Mining Company by Marcus Daly after convincing partners to join him in mining silver. But after only finding little deposits of silver, they found that this mine's content was mostly copper. His partners wanted out of the project, but Daly still had hope in this mine and decided to buy them out. He quickly built the mine to extract copper, and by 1889, it produced about 3,000 tons of copper daily. it became one of the leading copper mines in the whole country, and Montana became the biggest producer of copper in the nation as well. Because of its success, it led to Daly expanding the company by getting into the timber industry and buying out many acres of forest in Butte. The success of this company had such profound effects on the state of Montana that it almost became the state's capital. But at the turn of the century, it had one problem that kept persisting: labor disputes. Mining became an increasingly capital-intensive and unsafe work environment for the people who worked in the mines. In 1955, Anaconda decided to stop underground mining because it was uneconomical. By the time ARCO would buy the mine, copper prices were slumping and unions in the city were creating proposals to regulate the mine so it could pay the workers who had been recently laid off a severance for around a year in 1982. By 1983, ARCO would lose over $100 million on this investment, where they made the decision to close the mine as a way to limit their losses by 1985. Frank Gardner, an executive at the mine, explained the problems in his oral history, where he said, 1980-81, we lost, there's around 1,306 employees in the Berkeley pit. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. And the 2 years, 81, we lost $65 million, 82, we lost $35 million. And then in 83, we only worked 6 months and made $7 million. But we just started cutting back. And so I was, a lot of people don't believe this, but it's true, that I was the one saying that we got to shut the mine down. It was in Denver. Here, as I said, we got to shut the mine down, and there's four or five things that had to be done. The taxes are way out of kilter. The environmental issues are becoming more and more. And like I said, by the time we shut down finally, they told the agreement was that we would shut down at the end of the contract in 1983, June 30th. And we'd be down for a year to try to take care of this. Atlantic Richfield, which is ARCO, was going to start a molybdenum mine down in Nevada to supply the contracts in Europe on that part of it. So that's where we went. And finally they did. And we shut down in 83 with the idea that in 84 we would go back to work and have a lot of this. Well, guess what? Atlantic Richfield decided that they're getting out of the mining completely. They had enough. And probably the biggest thorn then, probably their biggest worry was Butte, which was the Anaconda mine, and it was already down. So they booked $1 billion to get out of the mining business, and then a week later, they upped it to $1.1 billion. So they threw another $100 million in there. So they want to get out of the business. So there we are, in 1983, you know, and all of a sudden, we're not trying to solve the problems. We're trying to sell the mine. And we had big companies in the States, you know, Kennecott, Phillips Dodge, Asarco, and all of them. And none of them were interested. And the two things they mentioned was labor and the environmental disputes, of course. Anaconda was a mess. And the executives, as well as the state government of Montana, wanted to find a fix to bring it back to use. Even though ARCO closed it down because it had lost them $100 million a year while it was in operation, by closing it down, the once flourishing economic producer it was in the state ceased to exist. This meant that the very unions who kept arguing for higher pay had no job as well. The city of Butte was now losing money from potential tax revenue. Dennis Washington, meanwhile, was watching this all unfold in his home state of Montana when he was operating his construction company. He planned on buying the machinery used to mine the copper to use for scrap parts. But after reaching out to purchase the machinery, the executives like Frank Gardner at Anaconda convinced him to look at buying the whole company. Gardner later explains in his oral history, saying, "So anyway, who comes to the mine? Well, I met him earlier when we were in 1980, Dennis Washington. And he comes in mine to buy. We were trying to get rid of all this junk we had at the mine, you know. So many people now, we had all these old trucks. So he wanted to come to buy the trucks. Here comes Dennis, and he's got a silk scarf on and a little fringe hat, you know, the tassel on it. And I looked at that and I said, I'm not going to meet with this guy. So I told Chuck Hollows, our finance guy, he had to. And yeah, so he had talked to Dennis, and Dennis said he always wanted to make a better deal. And the trucks were cheap, and you know, we were trying to get rid of them. Then he said, well, I could go back to Minnesota and buy those trucks and bring them back to Montana. And I said, tell him, go ahead. You're going to have to tear down the damn trucks, and you're going to have to haul them back there and put them back together again. So I guess they must be getting them for next to nothing. So finally, we made a deal with him that there was an old shovel there, that we would sell that at our asking price. But there was a bunch of inventory for parts. So it was $200,000 to $300,000. So then he bought the trucks. So then when we were out looking for somebody to buy the mine, and he came in with and Dennis new equipment, and he knew that the value was, you know, he's sharp. But he came with a friend of his. That guy, the guy had scrapped out an iron mine in Wyoming and made a lot of money. So he partnered with Dennis and they came to Butte. And we still had a core group of people at the senior areas that could run the mine. So anyway, he comes and we put on our little dog and pony show, and we say that we think there's value in the rest of it. And Dennis says, okay. So he said it easily, and he said, I might come back by myself in a couple weeks. I said, okay, that's fine. Sure enough, he comes back. And we had one guy, Roy Willix, who was from Denver, that was heading up asset disposal for ARCO. He was there. And Dennis said, okay, I'll give you a price. And first of all, we said, we can't make those decisions. They have to be made down in Denver. And he said, well, let's go. And we did. I ran home, got a suitcase, and we went down to Denver. So September of 1985, we went down to Denver, and with Dennis, we were negotiating back and forth. Then we put Dennis in the assets disposal room with all the rest of the stuff. And it was amazing how much stuff in Montana was there. And he starts looking, you know, he comes back in and he says, hey, let's talk about everything in Montana, not only the mine, but everything else. So we came back in and we started haggling. At one point, Dennis threw himself with a suit on, threw himself on the damn floor and said, come on, walk all over me. You've been doing it all damn day here, you know. So anyway, he got a hell of a deal. The reason why I wanted to show this whole behind the scenes information on this deal is just to get a glimpse of what Warren Buffett means when he talks about a fat pitch. Washington had already made a career on building efficient teams that did construction all throughout the state. While he first approached the mine to buy the scrap parts for use for his own business, not only did he sense a great opportunity, but plainly so did all the executives at the Anaconda mine as well. David Tepper talks about this when he was buying bank debt after the financial crisis in 2009. In a lesson to teach his analysts, he would throw $20 bills on the floor and ask them, would you pick that up? Where his point to them was, the best trades were all just as easy as picking up money from the floor. This was that trade for Washington. Gardner already had a plan set in motion to open up a mine to extract molybdenum and copper without keeping the same workforce as before. But they weren't in charge. ARCO felt the need to get out of this investment because it wasn't their core competency. And they have already lost multiple hundreds of millions. Like I said, they lost $100 million within 6 years of purchasing the mine. And they even said they were willing to sink $1.1 billion into getting rid of these mines. The setup made this the ultimate fat pitch, which was a very willing seller in ARCO, executives that had a plan to reopen the mine profitably, and number three, assets that he was buying for much less than what they went for. Just by owning the machinery alone, he could recoup his investment. But this deal clearly was not without risks. The main problem that was highlighted by Gardner throughout this period was regulatory bodies that were fining the mine for environmental issues the mine caused and making sure the workers got fair wages. But it turned out, just like with ARCO, both the city and the unions were desperate to make a deal and knew that having the mine operational was better than keeping it closed. When ARCO owned the mine, the EPA was going to designate it as a Superfund cleanup site, barring it too hazardous to mine from. But after they shut down the mine, the EPA actually backed down. Butte also decided to drop its property tax bill of the mine from $5.2 million a year to $1 million a year for only 3 years. Even the power company offered to bill 15% less than what it would in the past. And on top of all that, a bank in Montana decided to give a loan of $12 million to Washington for the operations of the mine. All in all, Washington paid $13.5 million for the mine and had put an additional $6.5 million to reopen the mine. But with his $20 million investment, he got all the benefits I previously just mentioned as soon as the deal closed. But the deal still had that one big risk, which was dealing with the workers' unions. When ARCO owned the mine, they had to deal with 13 different unions to settle wages for the workers they hired. Each union argued to add more workers to the mine, but Anaconda executive Tillman knew it was inefficient when he said 98% of it did not involve pay, but union jurisdiction. Flexibility was the problem. It always took 6 to 8 people to do what one should be doing. In many ways, This reminds me of our previous episode, in which the setup was similar to Anschutz's Regal investment, with the problem of the environmental unions and capital investments on the mine behind itself. If Washington could just restructure the mine and open it while keeping operations efficient, he could still make a huge profit. Just like Anschutz had to find a simple fix to the weakening economics of the theater business, the one lever that would make this deal work was whether he could deal with the workers' unions. So, what was the solution? They just came up with getting rid of the unions altogether and hiring people themselves. Because the mine was closed for so long, people wanted jobs more than unions wanted to fight on their behalf. So Anaconda hired 325 non-union workers and paid them to operate the mines 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Instead of the 600 workers that the 13 unions represented who worked less hours, he paid a lower than average of $13 an hour, but he did one thing that was unique at this time. He let the workers make part of what they worked in profit of the actual mine. 10% would go to the workers, and as copper prices started to head up again, with prices rising on molybdenum, they actually ended up getting paid double what the national average miner was getting paid with no union help. To break down the Anaconda investment, Washington invested a total of $20 million, and only 3 years later, he got to take out over $100 million from this investment in 1989. The same year he negotiated to sell half of the mine to ASARCO for $125 million, making his total investment of $20 million, it returned him $300 million within 3 years. But just like with Anschutz and his AEG deal, Washington wasn't done. He used the mine as a platform to buy other ancillary businesses where he could do the same fixing he did with Anaconda. He paid $160 million for the Montana Rail System owned by Burlington Northern and renamed it the Montana Rail Link. This was a very similar setup to how he bought Anaconda. Burlington Resources was desperate to sell this rail system after losing money from keeping the line open after dealing with workers' unions. But this time, however, the unions were a lot more aggressive. Washington had to hire armed guards with him when he went to go negotiate, and just like his solution of profit sharing with the miners, he offered the same deal with the workers at the railway. He cut down the unions from 12 to 2, and got the labor expenses far below what it took to run the train profitably. As an added bonus, like in his Anaconda deal, Burlington added in the sale that it would be a customer of the rail line to use the lines for its own freight business. This gave the rail line a new guaranteed customer while also benefiting Burlington, because this now allowed them to use this line at a much cheaper rate than they were when they were operating it. By running the rail efficiently like the mine, Washington got to lower the price on using the rail line, which brought new business from customers who commonly use trucks for their shipping. After opening up the line, it was already returning $33 million a year on revenues of $120 million. Washington kept stumbling on these opportunities. Using his knowledge of machinery and skilled labor, he knew that ARCO owned other mines that it desperately needed out of, but were too contaminated to sell. Remember, they're planning on investing $1.1 billion to get out of this. This is what the $1.1 billion was planned to be spent for. So he ended up spawning another business because of this. In 1988, he spawned a business called EnviroCon, which cleaned up environmental waste. He got to be an ally to the EPA and started cleaning up different sites around the country. Going back to my comparison to AEG, this was very similar because just as each new team and new arena provided more business to sell into venues for promotions, Washington now owned his own conglomerate that used all his services. In the book, Opportunity Montana, author Brad Tyer explains it best when he wrote, "Among dozens of corporate properties under the umbrella of Washington companies, Dennis Washington owns EnviroCon, the remediation contractor hired by ARCO to remove the Milltown Dam and dredge the toxic sediments out of the Milton Reservoir. Washington also owns Montana Rail Link, the railroad line hired to freight the Milltown sediments into Opportunity. It is purely poetic resonance, though hardly coincidental, that Dennis Washington also owns Montana Resources, the company currently mining copper and molybdenum from Butte's Continental Pit Strip Mine, adjacent to the old Berkeley Pit, property he purchased from ARCO in 1986 after ARCO shut down the mines. Washington makes money mining the copper. He makes money cleaning up the copper mining waste. He makes money moving that waste to Opportunity." So just to show you guys, Washington learned a lot from this experience. While it took a lot of work to get the mine fixed up, a lot of what made Washington's investments in Montana successful was that he was the only prospective buyer of this sort of business. There was a serious barrier to entry for other investors to truly see the opportunity, and even with ARCO being a big player in oil and gas, not being able to figure it out, it only proved to be a difficult opportunity to sell to the investors on Wall Street. Washington himself noticed this when speaking about these investments when he said, "Once the pencil pushers at big companies decide it's time to sell, you can negotiate one hell of a deal." This was the first sentence of the Forbes article that talks thoroughly about how he got the mine and other businesses throughout the state. He refers to the pencil pushers as the executives that were working at ARCO headquarters and did not have any real idea of how to operate the businesses they owned. In these Montana deals, Washington in some ways stumbled into owning this mine and setting himself up to owning a monopoly in Montana. But the most important part of this is that he realized his edge and then used his expertise in machinery to play the same game as other investors by buying into companies that dealt with heavy machinery and construction to then fix them up and build up other regional monopolies. In 1992, he did the same playbook as he did it with Montana when the owners of a tugboat company called C.H. Cates & Sons in Vancouver wanted to sell their operation because the descendants were not interested in operating the company anymore. He bought them for $25 million in 1994, and then continued to buy each of the big tug and barge operators in the Vancouver Harbor to form a monopoly in that region. Washington again was one of the only people who would get to see this opportunity because it had to do with operating tugboats. Cates was a small company at the time, but it was one of the only tugboat operators in Vancouver. Washington acted quickly and purchased the company. Then after he did that, he did not waste any time and bought three shipyards, an intermodal ferry business, a container ship company, and more tug and barge transportation companies all throughout Vancouver. This gave him the same sort of deal he had in Montana. This is a typical platform private equity play where each new business acquired added more value. But again, he got to do these investments because of the intel he had when bidding for them. While he had virtually no presence in Vancouver, his understanding in machinery and operating complex businesses and markets that use machinery led him to have two regional monopolies in Montana and Vancouver that would make him a billionaire. The important thing we can learn from both of these deals that Washington did was how he got to leverage the edge that he had. The difference between what he did and what others did with the same information as him was that he looked outside of just applying his knowledge to just building a construction company. He compounded his edge to go from being one of the many construction companies in the United States to owning two separate conglomerates that are vital infrastructure to their respective economies. This is one of those moments where you have to realize that the saying of seeing the forest for the trees. When you could zoom out and see that you could apply your knowledge and expertise in different areas, you might uncover a very profitable adjacent business that your competitors have no idea about. To have a variant perception, you need to think differently. One of the ways to do that is to be an outsider in a particular industry and apply what you know within that industry. Washington did this and became successful by outwitting the quote-unquote pencil pushers so that he could own two distinct conglomerates. Phil Anschutz, like Dennis Washington, used his own expertise as a wildcatter to be an aggressive investor in railroads and telecom, which we also know from the previous episode, he became a billionaire from those two investments. But before we end our episode on Dennis Washington, I want to go over another different deal that did not pan out as well as the other two. Now imagine it's 1995 and you are Dennis Washington. You are finalizing some more deals to do after you successfully purchased C.H. Cates & Sons in Vancouver. You already got a taste of financial success from your purchases of the Anaconda and Montana Rail Link, but you know where your real passion lies. It's construction. It's your passion. You had all the fun in the world when you were building highways for your uncle. You got to go off on your own to do more deals and eventually showed your uncle who's boss after becoming one of the biggest construction companies in the state. Yeah, you made more money from the deals you did outside of construction, but that wasn't nearly as interesting as building things with your own hands. You want to work on your own original construction company, and you hear one of the biggest construction companies in the world, Morrison Knudsen, is going bankrupt. You view this as your chance to not only get back into the game, but to be one of the biggest players as well when you save it. This will set the scene of what comes next in Washington's life. Morrison Knudsen was a construction juggernaut that was based in Boise, Idaho. They did projects all around the world and had a reputation for being the best. Just to give you guys a quick resume of the things they built in their storied history, they built things like the Hoover Dam, they built the Bay Bridge connecting San Francisco to Oakland, they built an 800-mile oil pipeline in Alaska called the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and they were the only U.S. manufacturer of rail cars at this point, which was the mid-90s. But this company would later go under because the CEO running the company at the time, William Agee, would later try to build up the rail car manufacturing division, but would cause problems when his expansion in that unit created quarterly losses. Agee, the executive in question, would later try to hide these losses before quarterly earnings, and this caused distrust between his shareholder base, causing board members to fire him. Knudsen couldn't stop the bleeding and went into bankruptcy in 1995, but would be bought out in 1996 by Dennis Washington for $380 million. Washington combined his construction company with Morrison Knudsen to form the Washington Group International, or WGI for short. The plan Washington had to fix his company was to broaden the projects it takes so that it is more diversified and less likely to decline from the cyclicality of the industry. To do this, they bought the Westinghouse Government Services Group and then a year later purchased Raytheon's Engineering and Construction Division. This was when problems started to occur. When Washington signed off on the purchase of Raytheon's Construction Division for $53 million, this division had liabilities of $450 million and had a backlog of contracts that they agreed to before the sale. Quickly, this purchase would become the demise of the Washington Group International. After everything closed, Dennis Washington realized that the liabilities were understated and that the contracts that Raytheon accepted were too low to even make the deals profitable. This was considered a cardinal sin when making deals in the construction business for this very purpose. Raytheon freely negotiated these deals where WGI had to pick up the pieces to make it work. When WGI realized it would be far too costly to actually fulfill these projects, they left them entirely. This forced the company into bankruptcy again only 5 years later after Dennis Washington purchased them and cost Dennis Washington a total of $250 million. The lesson to take away from this is twofold. Understand that even great investors can even make mistakes. Although construction was his specialty and was the reason why he got into industries, he did not necessarily have a competitive advantage this time around when buying Morrison Knudsen. Instead, he made a beginner's mistake and bought a backlog from a firm to expand and ended up costing him dearly. And number two, which has a lot to do with the first point, is competing when you have an edge. With both of his home run investments in Montana and in Vancouver, he had a clear edge against his counterparties and used his experience in operating his own companies to fixing up these different businesses where people were desperate to sell it to him. This time around, he was an equal to Raytheon, and they took advantage of that, where he was aggressive trying to expand the business to be more diversified and less cyclical, where the risk-reward was just not worth it for him. Dennis Washington would later restructure the company because it was still one of the best construction companies in the world and still had customers wanting to do projects while it was still undergoing its bankruptcy. Coming out of the bankruptcy, they focused on investing in their employees since this was the most important part of the company and was their real edge when they were doing their projects. And then they sold the company later on in the 2000s. This would mark the end of Washington's time in construction, and he would now only own his railroads, mines, marine transportation, machine rentals, and environmental cleanup businesses. Today, his ownership of these assets are worth $7 billion, making him a billionaire many times over. And now, the only time he actually spends doing any real work with machinery is from his side projects of fixing and flipping yachts to other billionaires. And this will end our episode of Rainmakers on Dennis Washington. I hope you guys enjoyed the episode, and if you did, please subscribe and review. In the next episode, we'll begin a new journey to learn about the most successful real estate investor in America, Donald Brent. You guys don't want to miss this episode, so please subscribe and be ready for that episode to come out next week. See you guys next time.